Hoare's algorithm, remember, finds the order of some number x, right? So it says we want to find r such that x to the r is equal to 1 mod n. And, you know, because if you keep taking powers of r, keep taking powers of x, after r, you know, x to the r plus 1 will be x again, and x to the r plus 2 will be x squared, and so on. So eventually, after 2r, you'll get back to the same place, and 3r, and 4r, and 5r, you'll all get back to 1. And so r, this is a periodic function, and r then is the period, the minimum r for which this happens. Let's see. So in particular, we started by considering some idealized case where where this number r that we're trying to find divides 2 to the n. Okay? And so the way Hoare's algorithm works is we first, at this step, we calculate x to the a mod n. So we have the state. We start with a superposition over all possible powers. And then at this stage, we have x to the a mod n in the second register. And we have an entangled state. And then at the measurement stage, we collapse it to something that actually is periodic. I mean, this is periodic too, of course, but it's a periodic entangled state. But let's just focus on one particular value here, y. And then we get a sum over, what was I using? J. Sum over j of a0 plus jr, y. Right? And so this looks something periodic spikes, right, with a period of r between them. And the Fourier transform, and I mean, if you think about this, this is basically something that's a very simple periodic function in the amplitudes of the wave function. It's 1 at these places and 0 elsewhere. And then it repeats after r places. And so the Fourier transform does the Fourier transform on the amplitudes, and it gives us the period. So after the Fourier transform, we have this state, sum over c omega to the a0 c 2 to the n over r c 2 to the n over r. Okay? And then by measuring this register, we can, after a couple of tries of doing this, figure out exactly what r is. Okay? And one thing that there were a couple of questions about yesterday, which I feel still might not have been clear enough. This register here is n qubits, but we're thinking of it most of the time as a number from 0 to 2 to the n minus 1. Okay? And this register here is about is going to be log n qubits, I guess ceiling of log n, because log n doesn't have to be an integer. And again, we're thinking of it as a number from 0 to big N minus 1. Okay? And it's still OK to do like single qubit operations, like this Hadamard transform. Then we're just saying we're doing the, in that case, we're just treating these as individual qubits. And when we start to, so this one, since it's basically classical, I'll show you how to do kind of quickly. But this we'll still think of these as full numbers from 0 to 2 to the n minus 1 and 0 to n minus 1. But then when we start to write the circuit for the Fourier transform, well, the Fourier transform, I guess maybe I should write out the definition of the Fourier transform again. So the Fourier transform, because it has this 2 to the n, the phase is 2 pi I over 2 to the n, it's a Fourier transform modulo 2 to the n. So it's looking at periods for functions that are periodic by some factor, basically, of 2 to the n. Okay? And so the Fourier transform as a whole is kind of working with this as a number from 0 to 2 to the n minus 1. But when we write out the integral circuit for it, we'll be interested in single qubit gates. So we'll have to kind of do a conversion between the representation of this register as a number, a big number from 0 to 2 to the n minus 1, to the representation as a set of separate qubits. Okay? And that will be a big part of what we're doing, actually, when we write down the circuit for the Fourier transform. Okay? So anyway, does that answer your question about the overview, the big picture of Schrodinger's algorithm? Okay, good. Okay, so so the things we have to do today are talk about this, this, and this. So we're going from the big picture to the little picture of how to do each of these things. I'm not going to say a whole lot about the classical post-processing. It's kind of ugly, but I can summarize it, I think, pretty quickly. This one, like I said, is relatively straightforward. It's basically classical reversible computing. That's another sheet. So let's do that. So modular exponentiation, that's what we want to do. We want to take x and raise it to some power, exponentiation, and we want to do it mod n, so it's modular. So something, I guess I don't know how much experience you have as individuals with modular arithmetic. Okay. So basically, it works just like regular arithmetic. Right. So the definition of something mod n is you divide by n and you take the remainder. Okay. And a question came up about terminology. And so the mod n on the right is the same as the mod n on the left. It kind of applies to the whole equation, really. And you can mostly do what you want. So if you multiply, it just works the same. It carries through on both sides of the equation. If you add, it works the same, and it carries through on both sides of the equation. The main thing you have to worry about is, and if you subtract, it works the same, carry through on both sides of the equation. But dividing, you have to be a little bit careful about. Because in particular, if you're dividing by something that's not relatively prime with the modulus, then you can get into trouble. Because the problem is that in modular arithmetic, you can get kind of non-trivial products that multiply together and get you zero. Right, so if you're working, you know, modulo 6, 2 is a perfectly good number, 3 is a perfectly good number, but 2 times 3 is 6, which is 0. Okay, so if you're dividing by 2, well, that's like dividing by 0 a little bit. Not exactly the same, but the point is you have to be careful when you're dividing. So we're not going to do that. And that's actually related to the fact that, that's a separate story. So in any case, this we don't have to divide, we just have to multiply. We have to take powers, right? And the point is, we have to take a very big power. Okay, we have to take a power of up to possibly 2 to the n minus 1. Okay, but we want to do that quickly. We want to do it in a time that's polynomial in little n. Okay, so how do we do that? Well, the answer is to do some classical pre-processing that will help us along. So in particular, what we'd like to do, remember, we want to do this reversibly. So we want to take a register A, B to A, B plus X to the A. Right? That's the reversible version of modular exponentiation. What is the pre-processing? Well, we can pre-process by figuring out what a bunch of different possible powers of x are. And of course, we want to do this, I put kets around, so we want to do this as a quantum circuit. We want to do it coherently. We can pre-calculate, we know x already, and we can figure out quickly x squared by squaring x. And then once we have x squared, we can figure out x to the fourth by squaring x squared, and then square x to the fourth to get x to the eighth, and so on, all the way up to x to the 2 to the n. Actually, we don't really do 2 to the n. 2 to the n minus 1. OK? So this procedure is something that we can do efficiently. And in a moment, I'll calculate exactly how long it takes. Let's see. So then to do the actual quantum gate that we want to do, we take AB. And suppose A can be written as a binary number, right? So A, we can write it, in binary, in base 2. Base 2 expansion is going to look something like A n minus 1 plus 2 A n minus 2 plus 4 A n minus 3 plus plus 2 to the n minus 1 A 0. So if you write out in normal, base 2 form, A0 would be the biggest digit, and then A1, and then A2, and so on. Right? OK. And so what we can do here is we will add some ancillas and as the first step. And those ancillas will be this. So first, we'll take x, and we'll raise it to this first bit, or the least significant bit of A. So we either put an x or 1, depending on whether this bit is 0 or 1. Okay? And so that we can do. That's just basically a controlled operation. If this bit is 0, we do nothing here. We leave it as 1. If this bit is 1, then we put an x. Okay? And similarly, for the second register, the second ancillary register, we put x squared to the a n minus 2. And the third register will be x to the fourth to the a n minus 3, and so on. The last register here being x to the 2 to the n minus 1 to the a 0. OK? And then what we just want to do is we want to multiply together all of these things and add them to B, OK? And we can do that. That's just regular arithmetic. And then we're going to have to erase these things, of course. And so then what we do is we take B plus the product, x a n minus 1, x to the 2 a n minus 2, x to the 4 a n minus 3 times x to the 2 to the n minus 1 a 0. Okay, and then we have a bunch of zeros here. And of course, this is x to the a n minus 1 plus 2 a n minus 2 plus 4 a n minus 3 plus 2 to the n minus 1 a 0, which is a again. Okay, so this is what we wanted. This is a b plus x to the a, and then a bunch of zero ancillas. OK? Does everyone see that? So I want to make a point here that it's really important that we erase these extra ancillas that we used. OK? Because these extra ancillas have a lot, they have full information about what A is. Right? But we don't want that, because at this stage, after this function, we're supposed to have this entangled state. And what we'd like to do is we'd like to collapse on values and get a superposition over different values of A that have the same value of x to the A mod n. Right? But this register would instead keep track of exactly what A is. Okay? And instead, if we didn't erase those scratch bits, instead of collapsing on a state that looked like this, well, we'd have an entangled state between this and the extra registers. And we wouldn't get a superposition here. Basically, it would just be a mixed state if we look just at this register. Okay? And the Fourier transform would no longer be extracting the period of anything interesting. It would just be a delta function. Okay? You see that? So this is why, I mean, in classical reversible computation, erasing the scratch bits is, you know, it's kind of a nice thing. It means you can reuse them. You don't have to carry around so many of them. But in quantum computation, erasing the scratch bits is really essential. The algorithm just doesn't work if you don't do that. Okay? So how many steps does this take? Well, so calculating each of these takes, so the longest one of these, so we're doing this all mod n, right? So none of these numbers is longer than log n bits long. So squaring, doing one squaring, takes a time that's the same as multiplying together two log n bit numbers, right? And then taking the remainder is kind of not much extra time, not worth counting. So so each multiplication takes, well, if you use, you know, regular log multiplication, it takes time log n squared. Okay? And we have here little n of them. So therefore, we get a little, so the time is really O of log n squared. There's some constants. And so the total time then we get is O of little n times log n squared. OK? That was for the pre-processing step. But actually, this is the same, right? We have to, this part just takes a time that's little n, basically, order little n. I guess it's order little n times log big n. But that doesn't matter. That's still going to be lower order than this. And then multiplying them together, again, requires us to do n multiplications between numbers that are size about log big n. So So this step also takes time O of n log n squared. And we're, I mean, to, it's a little bit easier to write it just in terms of little n because you know, we don't have to keep track of two things. Little n we're going to pick to be order log n, as I said yesterday, about 2 log n. And so this is really about order n cubed. And so this is if you do kind of dumb multiplication, the simplest way that you already certainly know how to do. But like I said yesterday, there's some faster multiplication tricks that you can do. These are classical tricks. And with fast multiplication, you can, in principle, save time and do the whole thing in a time O of n squared log n log n. Okay? So basically, you're saving almost a full power of n. Little n is getting replaced. One of the little n's is getting replaced by log n log n. Okay? Now, to use this full optimal scaling, you need to be, because there's big constant factors out front here, you need to be using quite large numbers. But there's some kind of intermediate tricks that are faster than regular, you know, simple multiplication, but slower than this best-known fast multiplication algorithm that kind of fill in the gap. So, you know, you have to... If you really want to optimize, you have to look at exactly how big the number you are, numbers you're using, and figure out exactly what the best algorithm to use. And that will determine exactly how long it takes. Okay? Are there questions on this modular exponentiation part? Okay, So then let's move on to the Fourier transform. That's the interesting quantum part. So for the Fourier transform, again, it's helpful to write the number A. What we want to do is we're going to take, remember, A to sum over B omega to the AB B. Okay? So the input is A. And again, it's helpful to think of it in its in binary. Where is it? There. So again, we have A equals A0, 2 to the n minus 1, plus A1, 2 to the n minus 2, plus dot, 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 plus A n minus 1. And the output B, we can also write in binary in the same way. Okay. And then let's calculate what A times B would be, right? That's the phase that's going to appear up here. So A times B is going to be, well, there's going to be some big terms like A0, B0, 2 to the 2 times n minus 1. But we don't really care about terms like that, right? Because anything that's bigger, that's something times 2 to the n, is just going to give us a trivial phase, right? Because omega is a 2 to the nth root of unity. If you take it to some multiple of 2 to the n power, then it'll just be 1. Yeah?
When you get the representation of A for, in this particular form, you use the A and the clean actually.
Sorry, this one is the same, just the same as this one. I've just reversed the order. Was that the question?
Yeah, but I didn't get it.
Oh, you didn't get how I got that?
Yes.
Oh, OK. So I'm just writing it in phase 2. OK? So, so like 5, right? 5 is 4 plus no 2s plus 1. So it would be 1, 0, 1, base 2. And so this is 1 times 4 plus 0 times 2 plus 1 times 1, which is 2 to 0. Okay, so it's just this kind of generalization for that. Any other questions? OK, so A times B, there's going to be some stuff times 2 to the n. And we don't really care about that, because that's just going to give us a trivial phase. The interesting stuff is the first interesting term is going to be the power 2 to the n minus 1. So basically, we're trying to find the base 2 expansion of A times B. And we're ignoring the really big significant bits, because they give us a trivial phase. So 2 to the n minus 1, well, that will have a term from here, which is a0 bn minus 1. And we'll have a term here, b0 an minus 1. OK? But actually, we'll also have a lot of intermediate terms. I forgot about them because of dots. We'll have this term, it's a1 bn minus 2. And A2, Bn minus 3, and so on. Plus, all the way in the end, An minus 1, B0. Okay? And then we have a 2 to the n minus 2 term, which will be A1 bn minus 1 plus a2 bn minus 2 plus dot 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 plus an minus 1 b1 and so on. And the last term then is the 2 to the 0 term, which is just an minus 1 bn minus 1. Okay. So plugging this into the Fourier transform, if we want to calculate this, sum of omega to the AVB. Well, this we can again write in terms of B using its base 2 expression. And we have sum over B omega to the AV. And we have, so it turns out that it's in the case of the output B, it's easier to write it kind of in reverse order. So the qubits have been switched. Which one is the biggest one, which one is the smallest one? So we'll first write B n minus 1. And we have B n minus 2. And then dot, dot, dot. B n minus 1. Sorry, B 0. Okay? And this, well, the point is we can kind of take the sum over Bn minus 1 and factor out the appropriate phase that involves Bn minus 1 and do the same thing for Bn minus 2 and so on. So in particular, we have this term, sum over possible values of Bn minus 1, in other words, 0 and 1. And let's take the term in this sum that involves all the Bn minus 1 terms. Okay, so that's the first thing in each parenthesis here. So that's omega to the A0, 2 to the n minus 1, plus A1, 2 to the n minus 2, plus dot dot dot, plus A n minus 1. And this is times B n minus 1, and B n minus 1. Okay? And this is tensor with sum over bn minus 2 omega to the, well, for bn minus 2 we start with a1 2 to the n minus 1 plus a2 2 to the n minus 2 plus dot 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 plus the last one I guess then would be a n minus 1 times 2, b n minus 2, because b n minus 2 doesn't appear in this 2 to the 0 term. See? And here we have b n minus 2. And then, of course, this keeps going. And the last one would be sum over b0, omega to be a n minus 1, 2 to the n minus 1, b 0, b 0. So in particular, we can be writing this as, it's better to focus on the ith term. So we have here, so we're going to have the sum over b n minus I, omega to the ai minus 1 times 2 to the n minus 1 plus sum over j greater than or equal to I aj 2 to the n minus 2 minus j minus I. Sorry. Right. This is all in the exponent, b n minus I, and then go to b n minus I. Okay, so this is a bit of a mouthful, but basically this is the appropriate generalization of this formula if you work it out for the intermediate places. Okay? So So let's see. So what I want to point out here is that there's kind of two parts to this phase. So first of all, we'd like to take the ith bit. And the ith bit started, so now let's start putting together a circuit. So we're going to start putting together a circuit, and we started with the bits in order, okay, in regular order for the A's, the inputs, okay, and at the end. The end, we're going to take the B's in the reverse order. Okay. And so we need to do two things. First of all, even if we start with the basis state A, which is kind of the case we're considering here, we still want to end up with a superposition here, right, over both possible values of B. So we're going to have to, for instance, we might want to do a Hadamard transform. Because the Hadamard transform will take a basis state, 0, 1, into a superposition of both 0 and 1. Okay? So a Hadamard transform should be part, on each qubit, should be part of our circuit. But the other thing is we want to get this phase right. Okay? And this says what phase we need. And so if you look at it, you'll see it has two parts. So first of all, it has this part, where, so you'll notice here that, so if we have, in general here, we have AI in the I spot. Actually, maybe let's call this AI minus 1, because we're going from 0 to N minus 1. And the I spot here is going to be B N minus I. Okay? So, so this is the phase that goes with the I output qubit. And AI minus 1 is the value of the ith input qubit. Okay? So this part of the phase comes from just the same qubit that is going to be in the output. This part of the phase involves j greater than or equal to I. So it involves the qubits that in this picture are below. Is that right? Yes, that's right. It involves the qubits that are below the output qubit that we're considering. Okay? So in other words, the first qubit, we get a phase that involves all of the qubits. Right? That's this term. Whereas the last qubit only involves the phase associated with the last qubit involves only the last input qubit. Okay? Now to a certain extent this is fictitious. The phase is just something that's global shared by all the qubits. But I've written it in such a way that it's broken up between the individual qubits in this way. Okay? Okay, so how do we implement this in particular? Well, this phase, omega to the ai minus 1, 2 to the n minus 1, well, omega to the 2 to the n minus 1 is just e to the 2 pi I over 2. Right? So this e to the 2 pi over 2 is e to the pi I, which is minus 1. And so this is minus 1 to the ai minus 1. And that's, in fact, exactly the phase you get if you do a Hadamard transform. Right? Sorry. Here. Because we also have a bn minus I in here. So this is ai minus 1, bn minus I. So this is the input value of the ith qubit. This is the output value of the ith qubit. And this is the phase that we get for Hadamard transform, right? If both input and output are 1, we have a phase of minus 1. If either of them is 0, we have a phase of plus 1. Right. So what we're going to want to do is we're going to want to do the Hadamard transform in each qubit. And that will not only take care of the superposition, making this into a superposition, but it'll take care of this part of the phase. So let's do that. Here we have a Hadamard. And we're going to need some space. Let's put another Hadamard in here. And I won't try to guess how much space I'll need. Let's just leave this out for the moment, and we'll fill it in later. So let's concentrate on the first qubit first, OK? So for the first qubit, this is, in some sense, the most complicated one, because we have to involve the phases from everything. What phases do we need? Well, for the first qubit, we want, we had a phase of minus 1 to the AB for the first for itself. And then we have a conditional phase, A1, B, n minus 1. So that's between the first output qubit and the first input qubit. And the phase is, well, the square root of this. So it's going to be I to the A1, B, n minus 1. And so that corresponds to what I was calling before a pi over 4 phase. So you'll notice that this phase gate is occurring after the Hadamard on the first qubit, but before the Hadamard on the second qubit, right? And that's because it's a product between A1 and Bn minus 1, okay? The Hadamard puts the basis state here is Bn minus 1. And this one, we haven't done the Hadamard yet, so it stays as A1 for a moment, okay? And then we want to do the square root of this phase between this qubit and the third qubit. So that's a phase r pi over 4. It looks like that. And then we keep on doing these with taking the half the phase each time. So we get, here we have r pi over 2 to the n. Okay. And then this prepares the first qubit in the appropriate phase that we want. And then we don't have to use it again. Okay, we're done with it. So we can just draw this line through. Okay. And now we want to start on the second qubit. We do the Hadamard, and then we have to do a bunch of phases. And if you look, what's the what are the phases? We have a two to the n minus 2. Okay? So it's the same phase, which in this case was r pi over 4, that depends not on the absolute position of the qubit, but on the relative position between the two qubits. Right? So when there's one space between them, we want to do the phase pi over 4. And that's what this formula is telling you, basically. If there's two spaces, we want to do the phase pi over 8, and so on. So we repeat all of this, r pi over 4, etc. But of course, since there's one fewer qubit to do it on, we end up with a smaller phase in the last thing. We end up with r pi over 2 to the n minus 1. Oops. Okay. And somehow I still didn't end up with enough space. Oh well. Okay. And then, of course, we have to do a Hadamard here and a phase r pi to the 2 to the n minus 2 on this last qubit with some dots. And then a bunch more dots. And finally, we end up with the Hadamard on the last qubit and then the output. Okay? So it seems a little bit complicated, I know, but if you sit down and think it through carefully, then it works out all very nicely. But are there any questions maybe that people, yes?
You have to start like with the first qubit, like do all the phase states, and then right. Start the second qubit.
Well, these things certainly don't commute. So these gates are all diagonal, so they commute with each other. What matters is that you do all of them before you start doing these Hadamards.
Yeah.
Okay. So the Hadamards don't commute with these. These things commute with each other. That's definitely true. This set you can do in any order. But as long as you do all the stuff for the first qubit first, and you do the Hadamard before the phase states, and then you do all the stuff for the qubit, then you're okay. It may be that there's another version where you do the last qubit first. There's probably many circuits that will give you this Fourier transform. This one has a very nice structure, so it's easy to look at it and to remember it and so on. This is kind of the most common one used. I don't know actually another one that's the widespread use. But the other thing is that a different circuit might have different complexity. It might require more gates or even fewer gates. So you have to be careful, right? You want to make sure that the circuit that you write down is efficient, right? It won't take a lot of time. But other than that, there probably are other versions. It's just they'll have to be rather different. Other questions? Yeah.
I think as long as you do the Hadamard on the second qubit after you do the first C phase.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So
you move that Hadamard around a little.
Right. So this Hadamard certainly is commuting with say this controlled phase gate. Right, because this controlled phase gate only involves the first and the last qubits. And so something you do on the second qubit, it doesn't matter. So you have to do it after this thing, but it commutes with all the pieces. So that's true. So you can definitely have some additional freedom there. And if you can do stuff in parallel, then you can probably speed this up substantially. Other questions? Okay. So let's calculate actually how many gates we used in this circuit. Well, so we start out by getting the first qubit right, and that involved a single qubit gate and n minus one two qubit gates. Okay, assuming we can do these as fundamental gates, right? All of the exact kinds of gates, remember, depends on exactly which universal set of gates we're starting with. Let's just say we have all one two qubit gates. Okay, and then we're just going to calculate the order, right? So we don't really care about the constants, and that will save some of this problem. So where do we start? So we start with n gates to get the first qubit right. In the second qubit, we have one single qubit gate and n minus one two qubit gates. So that's n minus one gates. And then the third qubit, similarly, it's going to need n minus 2. And then the last qubit only needs 1. Okay? And so this, of course, is going to be n plus 1 cubed 2, which is order n squared gates. Okay? This part is the easy part, so hopefully you followed that calculation. Okay. Now remember that the modular exponentiation needed more gates. Even with fast multiplication, it required O of n squared log n log log n. So actually the kind of classical part of Schwarz's algorithm is the most expensive. I mean, it's not really the classical part because you're doing it on a superposition. But basically a classical circuit that you're implementing with quantum gates. Okay? So, it's possible, no one has come up with one yet, but it's possible there is, some clever trick to slightly speed up multiplication on quantum algorithm, with a quantum algorithm. In that case, this might change. And ironically, if you actually think about RSA, you also have to do a modular exponentiation. Okay? Now, in practice, people do kind of tricks where they pick, you know, e of a certain size and d of a certain size, so you can trade off on the difficulty. But basically, the classical complexity of using RSA is something like this. Okay, so Shor's algorithm can break RSA in a time that's comparable to the time that's used to actually encrypt or decrypt. And in Shor's original paper, he makes a comment that, you know, if somebody did come up with a better quantum algorithm for multiplication, it might be faster to break it on a quantum computer than it is to use RSA on a classical computer. But we don't know how to do that yet. So at the moment, it's still just kind of the same with classical. Okay? So, then I have one more thing to talk about in Shor's algorithm, which is this classical post-processing. Oh, no, sorry, I have two more things. So the classical post-processing, in the ideal case, is very easy. Because, like I said, you get C to the n of R. You have to do it maybe a couple of times to get all the factors of R, but then that's pretty straightforward. Yeah?
Is the one to row back, which
right.
How many qubits will I need to make this product? Because
right.
The integers they're using.
Yeah. So obviously it depends on how big an RSA key people are using. Typical size is like maybe 1,000 bits long. If you want to be really secure, people might use 2,000 bits or even 4,000 bits. So if you look at Shor's algorithm, so it's a little bit hidden because you need some scratch space for the modular exponentiation. But kind of the main part of Shor's algorithm, well, okay, so I haven't actually told you how big little n has to be yet. So I'll get to that in a minute. That'll be for the non-ideal case. But basically, little n has to be like about 2 times log big n. So the number of qubits you need is just really some relatively small constant factor times log n. You want to use some scratch bits for the modular exponentiation, but you don't really need that many. People have come up with some fairly clever ways. And I think the best actually takes the total number of qubits that you need down to something like 3 times log n. Okay. So that's not so bad. So if it's a thousand bit number that you want to factor, you need 3,000 qubits. Okay. Now there's a couple of catches. So one of them is that the number of gates is actually still quite large. So even though the number of qubits seems kind of, you know, it's far out for now, but it's not kind of hard to imagine that we could have that. The number of gates you need, which is, you know, not quite 4n cubed, but kind of getting up close to that. That's significantly larger, right? That's like, you know, a million gates. So n squared is already a million when n is 1,000. And so n cubed would then be a billion gates, which is quite a lot. Again, you can do a bit better than that, but it's significant. And the other catch is that for calculation of that size, almost certainly you're going to need quantum error correction and fault-tolerant quantum computation, which we'll talk about next week. And that will significantly increase the number of qubits you need, as far as we know. Okay. So to actually build a quantum computer that's capable of factoring large numbers, you actually do need quite a lot of resources. And there's much more detailed analyses you'll find in the literature of, you know, actually figuring out exactly how many qubits you need, exactly how many gates. But all of this is kind of dependent a little bit on future small improvements in each of these steps. That gives you a ballpark. Okay. So let me very quickly then go over the non-ideal case for Shor's algorithm. And I can do that quickly because basically it works pretty similarly to the ideal case. And I'm not going to go through the details because I don't find them very illuminating. They're a little bit ugly. But the main thing, so what we're dealing with now is the case where R does not divide to the end. Okay, so if R does not divide to the end, well, we still have this thing, this state here, after measuring a second register. Okay? The difference is that it no longer wraps around correctly. Okay? So it'll have a space R, and then R, and then R, and then R. But then when we get to 2 to the n minus 1, and we go back to the beginning, we end up in someplace different. Okay? And so what that means is that this function is not exactly periodic log 2 to the n minus 1. But it does still have a very big component of the period at R, or I guess multiples of 2 to the n over R. So what happens is after the Fourier transform, we have a state. So what's supposed to happen, I mean, in the ideal case, this would be a state that again looks like this, with very well-defined delta function peaks, basically. And these peaks are at multiples of 2 to the n of r. So this first one is 2 to the n of r. This is 2 times 2 to the n over r. 3 times 2 to the n over r, and so on. We don't have that anymore. Instead, what we have is something that looks more like this, where we have a narrow peak, but has some finite width, supposed to be more symmetric than that. And then another peak, and then another peak, and then so on. Okay? And the centers of these peaks are basically multiples of 2 to the n over r. Even though these things are not integers anymore. So basically, the highest value will be a bit different for different peaks, and it will be some number that's near the closest integer, really, to a multiple of 2 to the n over r. Okay? And so the point is that the bigger little n is, the more narrow these peaks are, right? Because that's our failure of periodicity comes because we're dealing with we're wrapping around. And so if we take longer and longer to wrap around, then the number of periods we have is larger, right? And the number of correct periods we have is larger. And so the fact that there's one that's wrong when it comes around back to zero becomes less significant. So the peaks get narrower, and it turns out that they get narrow enough for our purposes. When 2 to the n is about n squared. And so this is a number that I've been citing to you a couple of times. In other words, that little n is about 2 log big n. Okay, so that's why I wanted that value. Okay, and what that means is that when we measure with very high probability, we'll get the integer that's nearest to a multiple of 2 to the n over r. Again, as in the ideal case, we don't control which multiple. But once we know an exact multiple 2 to the n over r, then we can figure out this by a couple of iterations of Schrodinger's algorithm. Okay. So then there's the classical post-processing part. And so in the non-ideal case, this is done using something called continued fractions. So a continued fraction expansion, where is it? Okay. So continued fraction expansion is you take some number, which actually can be any real number, but we'll focus on a rational. In particular, we're going to focus on the number b over 2 to the n, which, remember, is supposed to be about c over r. And we want to find the rational number c over r. So b over 2 to the n
something other than a's. We can write this continued fraction that looks like this. We take some number c0, and then we add a fraction, which is 1 over c1, and plus 1 over c2, plus 1 over c3, plus dot, dot, dot. Okay? And so a continued fraction, so for an arbitrary real number, this continued fraction can go on forever. And this is well defined, right? Because each of the c's is supposed to be numbers, are actually supposed to be integers. And so this part is all less than 1, and this part is less than 1. And this part. So as you can see, the effects of the continued fraction terms get smaller and smaller as we go along. So this thing generally converges. And for a rational number, like b over 2 to the n, actually there's only a finite number of terms. Okay? And it turns out that because c over r is very close to b over 2 to the n, when it's sufficiently close, and that again is a function of how big we take little n, that c over r is actually given by some partial sum of this continued fraction expansion. So in particular, we have that c over r is equal to c0 plus 1 over c1 plus 1 over c2 plus dot, 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 and ending actually at, so this one might go on to cl, and this one could go on to cm for m less than or equal to l, less than l usually because it's not an ideal case. Okay. Now we don't a priori know when this is going to stop. But remember, this is a problem where we can check what the answer is. This is a problem in NP factoring. So what we can do is we can try different values of M, and then deduce possible factors for big N from that, and then we can test the factors to see if they work. Okay. And this also takes care of cases where we get too far off the peak. So if this thing is peaked, but it's not completely peaked. So there's some probability that we end up with something that's not the closest integer to b over 2 to the n. And then this won't work, and we'll get kind of junk. But again, that will give us some numbers we think might be factors. We try them, and it turns out they're not factors. And so we know it didn't work. Okay? And if you grind through all the mathematics carefully, you'll find that you don't have to do this very many times before you actually succeed in getting correct factors for big N. Okay? I know this is not very specific, but I wanted to kind of complete Shor's algorithm and tell you what's involved in making it all work. From my point of view, the most important things are this big picture, okay, and this Fourier transform circuit. Those are the things that are really that have the quantum mechanics in them. The rest of it is all just kind of number theory and getting it to work with the actual problem we want to solve. Okay. So are there any questions? No? Okay. So as usual, you'll have more opportunities to ask. Tomorrow, we'll come back and do another algorithm, Grover's algorithm. So.